From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. Timothy Treadwell lived among grizzly bears for 13 summers before he met a tragic end. Treadwell documented his experiences on video. On today's Fresh Air, filmmaker Werner Herzog tells us how he took Treadwell's footage and combined it with his own insights to create the new documentary, Grizzly Man. Also, we'll explore the phenomenon known as Harry Potter. John Powers compares the current craze to his childhood experiences buying the Hardy Boys mysteries. And Kevin Whitehead reviews simulated progress from the New York jazz trio Fieldwork. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, sitting in for Terry Gross. My guest Werner Herzog has been directing film since the 1960s and earned acclaim as a leader of the new wave of German cinema following World War II. Herzog has always been interested in physical and emotional extremes, and in recent years he's focused on documentaries. His latest, Grizzly Man, tells the story of Timothy Treadwell, an American who devoted himself to learning about and living among Alaskan grizzly bears. Herzog's film draws heavily on video diaries Treadwell kept, describing his life with the bears.
Most times I'm a kind warrior out here. Most times I am gentle. I am like a flower. I'm like a fly on the wall, observing, noncommittal, non-invasive in any way. Occasionally I am challenged, and in that case, the kind warrior must become a samurai, must become so formidable, so fearless of death, so strong that you will win. You will win. Even the bears will believe that you are more powerful. And in a sense, you must be more powerful if you are to survive in this land with the bear.
After 13 summers among the bears in 2003, Treadwell and his companion Amy Huguenard were attacked and killed by a grizzly. Among Herzog's best-known feature films are Aguirre, the Wrath of God, about a mad Spanish conquistador, Nosferatu, a retelling of the Dracula story, and Fitzcarraldo, about a man obsessed with building an opera house in the Amazon jungle. I spoke to Herzog last week about his film career and his new documentary. I asked him what Treadwell was trying to accomplish by living among grizzly bears.
Well, I think only he would have the answer, but unfortunately he's dead, and we can only try to read from and understand from his letters, diaries, photos, and video material that he has left. But apparently he saw himself in a great mission to save the bears, who apparently didn't need that much redemption or saving because they were relatively well protected in Katmai, in this case, Katmai National Park, a federal national park. But he was also a great educator. He taught school children over the years, tens of thousands all in all, for free, never solicited a fee, so he was on a real mission. But I do believe that he probably didn't save the bears that much as the bears saved him. He was a deeply troubled man, haunted by demons. He was an alcoholic, I mean, in a severe stage of alcoholism, and he speaks about it himself. And he had a near-fatal overdose, apparently heroin. So, and coming across the wild nature out there in Alaska and seeing the grizzly bears, that was like an epiphany for him. And he said to himself, I must protect the bears. This is the great mission in my life. All of a sudden, and he says so in the film, he has a life. He had no life before. It was in shambles. It was a chaos. It was dangerous. And he was on the verge of getting killed or killing himself. Now, I think the bears redeemed him more than he redeemed the bears.
You know, I was going to play a clip from the film. This is from one of Timothy Treadwell's video diaries in which he talks a bit about kind of what this mission in his life has brought him. Let's listen to this. This, again, is from my guest Werner Herzog's new documentary, Grizzly Man.
I have no idea if there's a God, but if there's a God, God would be very, very pleased with me. If you could just watch me here, how much I love them, how much I adore them, how respectful I am to them, how I am one of them, and how the studies they give me, the photographs, the video, and take that around for no charge to people around the world. It's good work. I feel good about it. I feel good about myself doing it. And I want to continue. And I hope I can. I really hope I can. But if not, be warned. I will die for these animals. I will die for these animals. I will die for these animals. Thank you so much for letting me do this. Thank you so much for these animals, for giving me a life. I had no life. Now I have a life.
And that was Timothy Treadwell from my guest, yeah. Werner Herzog's new documentary, Grizzly
How
Man.
How tragic to hear this voice, because very shortly after that, he was killed and devoured by a grizzly bear together with his girlfriend. It really makes me ache when I hear his voice like that.
It is interesting that he survives 13 summers of the bears, living in close proximity to grizzly bears. But the summer that he perishes comes on an occasion in which he stays later than he normally would. What was he doing in the grizzly maze so late in the season?
Normally he would stay the end of the season, that means until something like end of September out there, and then it would get cold and the bears would move into their dens for hibernation. They sleep 6 months, half the year they sleep and they dream. So he was ready to return to California, and at Kodiak Airport there was an altercation with an airline employee. Very nasty, apparently, and Timothy Treadwell writes in his diary, and he writes, and that appears very often, how much do I hate the people's world? So he made a distinction between the people's world and the animal's world. And spontaneously he decides, leave all this behind and return to the bears for at least another week or so. And he returns to this area, dangerous area, which he calls the Grizzly Maze, and sets up his camp with his girlfriend, Amy Huguenard. And literally the day when they're ready to be picked up by a pilot, by one of the bush pilots, they apparently got killed. And it was a chain of coincidences.
Does it seem likely that he might have been killed not by the bears who he had come to know well over 13 seasons, but by other bears who were out late, probably hungrier.
Yes. And wilder, and not as much accustomed to the presence of a human being. When he returns, he writes in his diary, most of his bear friends were gone into hibernation, and wilder, scarier, more aggressive bears, hungrier bears, big bears from the backcountry had moved in and taken over the stream where there was a last little bit of the salmon run.
He shot more than 100 hours of video. I think was used to running the video camera at all kinds of encounters with the bears. And as it happens, a video camera was running in this last tragic attack when both Treadwell and his girlfriend, Amy Huguenard, were killed by the bear. The video camera was running, but with the lens cap on. So, in effect, there was an audio record of the attack itself. Now, we don't hear that audio in your film, but you do listen to it. Tell us, was it your decision or someone else's not to air that audio? How did you decide to use that in the film?
It was very easy to decide this because I listened to it in presence of the guardian or the custodian of Treadwell's materials, Jewel Palovac, who had founded Grizzly People, a non-profit organization together with Treadwell, and she's holding all the rights to his books and photos and videos and so. And she allowed me to listen to it, and it was instantly clear for me, under no circumstances whatever, that is going to be published. Number one, it was clear to me we are not doing a snuff movie. Number two, it occurred to me instantly, you have to respect the privacy of and the dignity of an individual death. You don't drag it into the open. So not permissible, and of course Jewel Palovac wouldn't have agreed either, even though she never listened to the tape, and she has not done so until this very day. And I gave her in this moment an advice which was kind of not very wise, I would say rather stupid, what I told her. Destroy the tape. It's sitting in your room like the elephant. She pondered over this for a while and then did a much smarter thing. She kept the tape intact, but separated herself from it, and she put it in a safe deposit in a bank vault. Mm. So now it's locked away, and it's not sitting in her in her shelf in her living room anymore, and I think it was a wise decision.
You described the conversation you had with Jewel Palovac about this audio that she possessed of Timothy Treadwell's death at the hands of a bear. And the interesting thing is that the advice that you gave her to destroy it, we actually see you rendering that advice in your documentary, and an occasion which you are sitting face-to-face with her. You have headphones on, and you are actually listening to this audio of her very, very dear friend being attacked and eaten by a grizzly bear. So there is an odd presentation of this horrific moment. I mean, we see her face as she reacts to
all
your
the
face.
Anguish. And that's, I think it's one of the most accomplished moments in film that I ever made in my life. You see me only halfway from behind, and I'm not important, but you see her face in anguish, trying to read my face, what I'm hearing. So it's a very, very strange and deep moment, and I love this moment, and I love how it ends. It was all spontaneous. I knew it will not be published, and she's in deep, deep, deep anguish, and I think she starts crying, and I reach over to her. It's very silent, very laconic, and one of the finest moments I ever shot in my life.
My guest is Werner Herzog. He's a legendary filmmaker. His new documentary is called Grizzly Man. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're speaking with filmmaker Werner Herzog. His new documentary is called Grizzly Man. You tell us at the end of this film that Treadwell's story isn't so much about nature, which he seems to think it is, but a look at into ourselves and our nature, and this gives his life meaning. What does his story tell us about ourselves?
Well, it certainly is not a film about wild nature. I ignore much of that footage, and he has dozens and dozens of hours of fluffy bear cubs with playing with mom bear, and he has dozens and dozens of hours of bear fishing for salmon and bears roaming the landscape and so. But the real interesting side of what he filmed, because he pointed his own camera at himself very, very often, he wanted to be a movie star. He was actually a failed movie star as well. Tried to get into some TV soap operas and shows like Cheers. And he wanted to be a star and points the camera at himself. And now all of a sudden we gain insight into the human nature, into the human heart, their souls, into our human condition more than anything I've seen in a long, long, long time. And that's a great value of his footage. And it's all his turmoil. It's him being haunted by demons, him in exhilarations, in joy, in jubilation, dejected, in self-deceit, in moments of paranoia, in moments of victory, in moments of defeat. Everything that's human life, human existence, human condition. And it's wonderful that we have that. And that makes him so big that he is way, way, way beyond a wildlife cinematographer.
In recent years, you've done a lot of more documentaries. And I was curious about, as someone who has spent so much time in feature films, creating an image from scratch, if it's a different skill to tell a story where you are capturing and editing images in reality. You don't like cinema verite, where you just present a chronicle.
Yeah, I think cinema verite somehow doesn't make a clear enough distinction between fact and truth, as if facts constituted truth. But there's quite a distinction that I make, and I'm after something that you find in great poetry. When you read a great poem, you would instantly notice that there's a deep truth in it. You don't have to analyze the poem in academic ways and all this. You know it instantly, and it passes on to you and becomes part of your inner existence. And it's the same thing in cinema. It's in great moments of cinema, you are hit and struck by some sort of enlightenment, by something that illuminates you. And it's a deep form of truth, and I call it an ecstatic truth, the ecstasy of truth. And that's what I'm after, and I'm after that in documentaries, in feature films. And in documentaries, you can't even call my documentaries, because I fabricate, I invent, I write dialogues for it. So the borderline between documentary and feature films is quite blurred and doesn't exist like this for me.
Well, when you say you fabricate, I mean, do you mislead your audience? I mean, would they think things are true or not? No,
but they would normally know what I'm going after, and it's fine. But sometimes I do rehearse a statement. Let's say in Little Dieter Needs to Fly, Dieter Dengler, who is the leading character in the film, who was shot down over Laos in the early phase of the Vietnam War. And he's telling stories, what happened to him, and he goes into details that are totally uninteresting, and I stop everything and I start rehearsing the story with him and getting the details that are fascinating for the audience. And so I maneuver and I rehearse and I shoot six times over, like in a feature film. Not that that anything untrue is coming across.
You want to capture that version of reality that betrays the inner truth of it. Yeah.
Yes. Right. And sometimes I create an inner truth. I invent in order to gain a deeper insight.
One of the things I wanted to ask you about was that in your documentaries, it is your vision, and we hear your voice, and we hear your ideas. And I'd like to play just a bit of your voiceover from your recent documentary, Grizzly Man. This is my guest, Werner Herzog. And I will just tell our audience that, although it's not critical to my point, in this particular piece of the voiceover, we are seeing a close-up of a large grizzly bear who at times looks directly into the camera.
And what haunts me is that in all the faces of all the bears that Treadwell ever filmed, I discover no kinship, no understanding, no mercy. I see only the overwhelming indifference of nature. To me, there is no such thing as a secret world of the bears, and this blank stare speaks only of a half-bored interest in food. But for Timothy Treadwell, this bear was a friend, a savior.
That's my guest, Werner Herzog, from a voiceover in his new documentary, Grizzly Man, about Timothy Treadwell, who studied bears and was ultimately killed by one. You know, of the five or six moments in the film that really stuck with me, that was one of them. What do you think your voice brings to your documentary films?
I think there is, for the audience, a person recognizable behind the movie. It's not just an anonymous film that you normally would see on TV and you hear a well-polished voice in the studio and done by an actor. Here you can identify the human being behind the film. And you even see me once for something like 30 seconds on screen, but from behind. So I thought this was right and good, and don't hide in anonymity behind your movie.
Well, it's interesting because I think your voice does bring, it just is weighted with authority and insight. And it's interesting to me that we hear your voice so much in your documentaries. You don't cast yourself in your feature films, do you?
Not really, no. But in some of my feature films, I appear very fleetingly, for example, in my very first feature film, Signs of Life, there was a German soldier and we had an extra in Greece on a Greek island, and the extra didn't show up. And the only one in the crew who would fit into the costume was me. So I slipped into into a soldier's outfit and I'm visible there for 20 seconds or so. I do that. But I have acted in movies like Harmony Korine's Julian Donkey Boy. I'm really as an actor. Or in Zach Penn's Incident at Loch Ness and in about a dozen other films.
Right.
But that is pure acting work.
Do you think that it's a mistake for you to act and direct, or is that you are not, no, your face is not the vision?
In my own movie.
Yeah.
In my own movie, I try to avoid that. But if somebody else makes a film, and like Harmony Korine, it was a very pleasant sort of work because I had to play a dysfunctional, hostile, vile and base father of a completely chaotic family whom I'm harassing everyone. And that came easy to me, and I'm good as vile as it gets and as horrifying as it gets. And I'm doing all right with those things, but in my own movies I wouldn't like to act.
You do rage well, huh?
Yes, and the strange thing is that people believe that in normal life I'm full of rage and full of wild stuff. I'm the only one who is always quiet, completely like a surgeon with doing surgery. Never a loud word, professional, focused. And I'm always the only clinically sane person on a set. they translate qualities of Klaus Kinski, the raving madman and hysteric into my person, which I am not, but it's okay. I can live with it easily. To take my word, I'm the only clinically sane far and wide.
Filmmaker Werner Herzog, his new documentary is called Grizzly Man. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air comes from this and other NPR member stations, and from Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor audio courses, which include Everything You've Been Taught Is Wrong by James Lowen, author of Lies My Teacher Told Me. Additional support for NPR comes from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, despite the hype, John Power says kids are lucky to have the Harry Potter series. He'll tell us why. Also, a review of the new album Simulated Progress from the jazz trio Fieldwork. And we continue our conversation with filmmaker Werner Herzog. He has a new documentary called Grizzly Man. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. We're speaking with filmmaker Werner Herzog. His new documentary, Grizzly Man, tells the story of Timothy Treadwell, a self-taught American naturalist who lived among Alaskan grizzly bears and was eventually killed by one. Herzog has directed more than 50 films and was a leader of German cinema in the post-war period. Several of his feature films starred the temperamental actor Klaus Kinski. Two were set deep in the Amazon jungle: Aguirre, the Wrath of God, about a crazed Spanish conquistador, and Fitzcarraldo, in which a man obsessed with bringing opera to the jungle hires hundreds of Indians to haul a massive steamship over a mountain to reach his rubber plantation. Herzog's epic struggle to make Fitzcarraldo is chronicled in a documentary by Les Blank called Burden of Dreams. It's now available on DVD. Anyone who has seen the documentary, the Les Blank documentary, Burden of Dreams, right. Which is about, it's a remarkable film about your making of your film, Fitzcarraldo, which for audience who haven't seen it, it tells you a three-year epic and all the difficulties you overcame filling this incredible story deep, deep in the Amazonian jungle. And your star then was Klaus Kinski, who, as you note, was legendary for his tantrums and rages. And there's a famous story, which I think you told when you spoke to Terry Gross years ago, of when Klaus mm-hmm. threatened to leave the set and you got him to stay by promising that if he left, you would follow him down the river and shoot him.
I would just open fire, but I was unarmed, of course, but he knew it was not a joke. He screamed for help. He screamed for the police.
I wanted to ask you, since Klaus Kinski on this set when you were making Fitzcarraldo, there were many, many times when people had to wait for days at times, weeks, yeah. And he would go into these rages. And you also had, in addition to the European cast there, you had scores, maybe hundreds of indigenous people, Indians, who
sure.
were observing yeah. this raving madman actor. How did they react to Kinski?
Well, they would huddle and whisper, and then they would fall silent. They would form a circle with their backs out there, and they would huddle, and they were kind of afraid. The funny thing is that the chief of all these tribal people came to me after one of those mad rages, raving and ranting of Kinski and screaming for hours. He came to me and he said, you have probably noticed that we were kind of afraid. And he says, but don't you believe that we were afraid of this raging madman who is screaming about? They were afraid of me because I was so quiet. They were really afraid of me.
Right.
You see, and in the same movie, I had to... Right. to hoist a huge steamboat in one single piece over a mountain with 1,100 savage, quote-unquote, savage Indians, and with no technology, literally no modern technology. And that boat weighed a couple of hundred tons, and I don't know if you can imagine what that means. So, and we had two plane crashes, and we had all sorts of things, and Kinski screaming and yelling and throwing tantrums every 2 hours. So you gotta live with it, and you gotta somehow fortify yourself with enough philosophy.
Did the Indians ever offer you any help with Kinski?
Yeah, well, they wanted to kill him, and they asked me, shall we kill him for you? And I said, no, I'm still shooting. I still need him. It is not a joke.
Right.
They would have done it in 10 seconds flat.
Wow. Well, we should note for the audience that in fact, you and Kinski remained friends after that, made films after that. And
of course, yes.
And of course, he died many years ago. He's no longer with us. But he was unique. In the documentary Burden of Dreams, which is about your making of Fitzcarraldo, we see that Mick Jagger was originally in that cast and then was replaced because there were delays and he had a concert schedule he had to get to, and you wrote him out of the part. There simply wasn't anybody else who could play the role that you envisioned for him. What was so unique about Mick Jagger that he simply couldn't be replaced?
Yeah, all of you haven't seen the footage because I threw it away at the end, and a very few moments have survived in Les Blank's film Burden of Dreams. But Jagger is a man who has not really properly been discovered yet as a great actor. And he was formidable. He was really wonderful, and I loved him for his abilities. And when he had a stop date, of course, for going onto this world tour with the Rolling Stones, when I started shooting all over again, this time with Klaus Kinski, I knew I wouldn't have time enough to finish all the sequences that had him involved. So I said to him, Mick, I have to leave you in in peace go back home, but I'm going to write out this part. Nobody will replace you. And this is my opinion until this very day, and I have no regrets that I didn't replace him by anyone.
It seems often you get an idea that an actor fits. He embodies a role. And you go after that actor. You don't believe in method acting at all, right? This character, all this endless character study.
I have no idea what they are doing, but I think it's much baloney there. And I do have a strong sense for casting. I do not make mistakes. I do not make major mistakes. Of course, everyone makes mistakes, but if I didn't have that in me, I wouldn't be a director. I wouldn't have gotten beyond my second movie.
You know, one of my favorite of your movies, in fact, one of my favorite of anybody's movies, is Strozek. And it's this tale of this man who gets out of prison, of man, I guess one might say, of diminished mental capacity. He hooks up with an abused prostitute and an eccentric old man, and they make their way to, of all places, Wisconsin to start a new life. And it's just a remarkable story. And one of the interesting things about this is that the lead in this, who plays this disheveled man, is a gentleman by the name of Bruno S., right, who was not an actor at all. Now tell us about what you saw in him and what brought him into your movies.
I saw him by coincidence in a documentary made by a young Berlin filmmaker, a film student, about marginal people who are doing street singing, and he was one of them. And I instantly knew that man had to be the leading character in Kaspar Hauser. Actually, in fact, he was a forklift driver in a steel factory, but he had spent 23 years locked away between his third year of age until he was 26. What happened was he was the son of a prostitute who didn't want this child. And she beat up that baby so severely all over the for no reasons whatsoever. And when he was 3 years old and he was speaking already, she beat him so savagely that he lost speech, and that was a pretext for her to get rid of him, and she put him into an asylum for retarded and insane children. And he spent something like 6 years there until he was nine, started to escape, was recaptured, ended up in correctionals and in some sort of mild forms of prison, and then he had a long career of minor offenses, vagabondry or breaking open a car in winter when it was bitterly cold and he was homeless. And he would sleep in a car and police would drag him out, and he got 4 months in jail for that. So for 23 years he was locked away and systematically somehow destroyed by society. And he had an illuminating power inside of him, which you cannot describe unless you see the movies. And he never wanted to have his name released. I said to him, "You are the anonymous, the unknown soldier of cinema, and I want to construct the monument for the unknown soldier for you."
What was he like to work with on a movie set? I mean, clearly not someone who was a trained actor and who brought a lot of difficulties.
Complicated, because he had moments of utmost despair and would talk to me in the middle of a shot. Just look at me and start talking to me for 2.5 hours. Of course, the camera would stop, and I insisted that the entire crew would freeze in their positions and listen attentively what he was saying to me. He needed that, and I took the time, and I was okay to guide him. And his work in these two movies I made is unprecedented in depth and in beauty.
And what became of him after those two movies?
He never wanted to become a movie star, but he, of course, he became better known, and the the barber gives him a free haircut and the pastry baker drags him in and gives him a cake whenever he walks by and they are proud of him. It improved his the climate around him. And he actually worked as a street singer on weekends during the week as a forklift driver. And he retired. He retired a couple of years and he lives on pension now in Berlin.
My guest is filmmaker Werner Herzog. His new documentary is called Grizzly Man. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Werner Herzog. He's made more than 50 films. His latest documentary is Grizzly Man. Well, Werner Herzog, you're making documentaries still, and many of them take you to remote places and involve people who are doing things at the limits of exertion, taking mortal risks. In your recent documentary, Wheel of Time, which chronicles hundreds of thousands of Buddhists who trek to observe the initiation of Buddhist monks, if I've read this right, you actually journeyed into Tibetan mountains and did a lot of filming where you were the entire crew. You did all of the shooting, you did all of the sound while coping with altitude sickness at 19,000 feet above sea level. And I'm just wondering, didn't anybody ever tell you that a famous director should have a big crew and a trailer where you get cappuccino and brioche in the morning?
Not so around Mount Kailash.
Right.
When you circumambulate this mountain in this particular year with about 100,000 pilgrims, you climb up to sometimes 19,000 feet. And I actually was not didn't suffer from altitude sickness. My wife did, who is a very athletic person and younger than me. Anyway, and what was interesting is that I shot the footage myself as a cinematographer because we didn't have any shooting permit in China or Tibet, rather. But all the other film that was shot in Bodh Gaya, the place where the authentic Buddha had his enlightenment under a tree, that was shot together with 500,000 pilgrims by a real crew and a cinematographer. I'm not into dangerous or remote locations. For example, a jungle is just another forest. So what?
All right.
There's nothing special about it.
You do push yourself hard, though. You know, in the documentary.
I'm not into self exploration and trying to push myself and finding my boundaries. That's all baloney. I'm not into that.
You're into making a good film and telling a story.
I'm not in experiencing myself. I'm a storyteller, sure, and I'm a filmmaker and I'm a poet to some degree, and that's as simple as that. And if there are difficulties en route, I just take it as they come, and I will tackle it so in a soldierly manner.
Right, right.
I try to be a good soldier of cinema, that's it.
Well, you certainly have taken on some difficult projects, and in Burden of Dreams, the documentary about the three-year saga to make Fitzcarraldo in the Amazonian jungle, there's a point where you say you should probably give this project up, but if you did, you would be a man without dreams, and you don't want to live like that. You were 37 when you said that. I guess you're, what, 62 now? Are you still someone who has to dream to live?
I do not know. I wouldn't be myself. And the strange thing is I do not dream at night. I have no dreams. And I wake up in the morning, and I feel this void. I have not dreamt again. So maybe that's one of the reasons why I do movies.
Well, Werner Herzog, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Filmmaker Werner Herzog. His new documentary is called Grizzly Man. Pianist Vijay Iyer is a rising jazz star, groomed by gigs with Steve Coleman, Roscoe Mitchell, and Wadada Leo Smith. But Iyer may be better known for his own projects. One of those is a cooperative trio called Fieldwork, whose members believe in rehearsing a lot to foster a free flow of ideas and create a real band aesthetic. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says all that practice pays off.
Fieldwork is a jazz power trio for the new century, one that packs the wallop of a rock band, at least sometimes, a little like their contemporaries, the Bad Plus or Jason Moran's Bandwagon. Fieldwork may get stuck on repeated licks, like a glam band hammering home a tune's hook, but one saving grace is they don't dumb down the solos. Jay Iyer on piano. He could come up for air once in a while, but you can hear why jazz folk like him more and more. A percussive pianist who doesn't punish the instrument, he'll spin long, intricate lines without tripping over his own fingers, and he has a sure feel for knocking out complex rhythms. Those stem, at least partly, from his study of the Carnatic music of South India, where his parents are from. And those shifting beats also recall the Indian-influenced jazz-rock fusion of the 1970s. Iyer was raised in Rochester, New York, where he grew up all-American multicultural, eating Indian snacks, digging Star Wars, and practicing Rachmaninoff on violin. The young fiddler switched to piano after discovering how much fun it was to make its low notes sing out, a childhood enthusiasm that stayed with him. I like how piano and drums lock into contrasting beats there. Vijay Iyer's trio mates, as heard on Fieldwork's CD Simulated Progress from the Pi label, are saxophonist Steve Lehman, who's new to the band, and drummer Elliot Humberto Cavi, who's since moved on. Those personnel changes reflect how hard it is to get busy New Yorkers to clear lots of rehearsal time. Still, Fieldwork achieves a hard-edged unity of purpose, with everyone pulling together, like I say, more like a rock than a jazz band. The trio has no bass player, and everyone works hard to compensate. On Lehman's tune Trips, drums evoke a scratchy rhythm guitar, the saxophone plays the sort of repeating line a bassist might play, and the whole band traces a hiccuping rhythm pattern. Fieldwork thrives on off-center grooves like that. Elliot Cavi is typical of younger jazz drummers who've absorbed hip-hop beats into the vocabulary without sounding mechanical. Saxophonist Steve Lehman has a slippery rhythm sense of his own, gliding between the beats or leaping over them. It's a good band, but I have one suggestion for those rehearsal sessions. Work on your endings. Pieces that start strong may peter out by the end. But when a band can make tricky technical stuff sound like musical populism, that criticism sounds like nitpicking.
Kevin Whitehead teaches English and American Studies at the University of Kansas, and he's a jazz columnist for eMusic.com. Coming up, John Powers on the Harry Potter phenomenon. This is Fresh Air. With so many eager fans anxiously awaiting the arrival of the newest Harry Potter novel, there was no doubt it would be a bestseller. In fact, within the first 24 hours, it became the fastest-selling book in history. Our critic at large, John Powers, is a fan, and even though he didn't join young readers waiting at midnight bookstore lines, he was tucked in bed, he understands their passion.
When the first Harry Potter novel came out 9 years ago, the whole thing seemed refreshingly innocent. Here was an unheralded little book that was discovered by kids who passed it from hand to hand like a talisman. All that seems a long, long time ago. By the time Harry Potter and the Half-Blood Prince was released this July 16th, the series had become a marketing event, with kids worldwide lining up at midnight to get their copy. These days, the act of buying a Harry Potter book is part of the Potter experience. Although it's easy to be cynical about such a triumph of commerce, I had a very different reaction when my 10-year-old friend Isabel told me about her midnight trip to the local bookstore. I was filled with nostalgia. You see, when I was a boy, I lived in an Iowa town so small it didn't have a grocery store. Every Thursday evening, we'd drive into Des Moines to go shopping, and on some of those trips, we'd stop at a Rexall drugstore out near the airport. It was there that they sold Hardy Boys mysteries, and as we neared the city, I would wait, heart thumping, to see if my dad would buy me a book with a suspenseful title like What Happened at Midnight or While the Clock Ticked. If he did, I'd devour the new book that same night, using a flashlight under the covers when I was supposed to be sleeping. The Hardy Boys turned me into an avid lifelong reader, for which I'll always be grateful. But the day I picked up the first Harry Potter novel, I realized how much luckier children are today. Although we keep hearing complaints that we're in an era of cultural decline, that everything is dumber and crasser than it used to be, this series is actually incomparably richer and more intelligent than the kids' books I used to read. In fact, the series is one gigantic bildungsroman, to use the lit crit jargon, the story of Harry's moral, psychological, and intellectual growth. Where the first books were filled with delights, we see Harry discover his amazing powers and explore the enchanted world of Hogwarts, the later books take him ever deeper into the murky depths of experience. Harry's friends die. The father he idolizes turns out to have been an arrogant bully. Hogwarts, like youth itself, is starting to fade. And even Harry is no longer an unalloyed nice guy. He learns that there's no small cost to that lightning flash birthmark on his forehead. All this is a far cry from the Hardy Boys. Through 40 mysteries, nothing ever changed in Frank and Joe's world. Least of all, Frank and Joe. In contrast, J.K. Rowling's work not only touches on all sorts of modern preoccupations, we feel the shadow of terrorism, but it offers a level of moral complexity and transformation missing from most adult bestsellers. Tom Clancy or Janet Ivanovich would be vastly better writers if they could give their heroes' adventures half the psychological depth of Harry's. Now, there is, of course, something extremely seductive about stories set in a static universe. It's reassuring that the Hardy Boys, 007, and Ray Romano are always the same. We like it that smug William Peterson invariably solves the crime on CSI, and that Larry David is perpetually aggrieved. Yet such static storytelling seems increasingly stale. We're living at a time when audiences are turned on by stories that show people and situations changing, often irrevocably. That's one reason why the HBO dramas have become such powerful cultural touchstones, the contemporary version of Dickens' serialized novels. From episode to episode, shows like The Sopranos, 6 Feet Under, The Wire, and Deadwood give you a world in the process of transformation. Fortunes rise and fall. Love blossoms and fades. Popular characters die or get whacked. In his book, Everything Bad is Good for You, Stephen Johnson argues that such transformational shows like The Sopranos actually make us smarter, at least compared to static ones like Law and Order, let alone Macmillan and Wife. I don't know about that, but I do know that there's no more thrilling experience in art than getting sucked into a story about how a hero grows into his or her destiny, with all the delights, disappointments, and surprises that such growth brings. And this experience is never more thrilling than the first time it happens, when you're a kid just discovering the full power of stories. Which is why when my young friend Isabel began gushing about the new Harry Potter, I didn't only feel nostalgia. I felt envy.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. His book about American culture, Sore Winters, will be available in paperback next week. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrells at 1-877-213-7374. Additional support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from V2 Records, presenting the White Stripes' new CD, Get Behind Me, Satan, available at Barnes & Noble and barnesandnoble.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we'll listen to the music of Robbie Fulks. The singer, songwriter, and guitar player is on tour across the country this summer. His latest CD is called Georgia Hard. Also, some midsummer reading recommendations. Join us for the next Fresh Air.